You would be turning your Bibles to Nehemiah chapter 1. Nehemiah chapter 1. We're going to spend a little bit of time looking at the background, and let me, for just a moment, retell the story of Israel. As we think back to the idea that God had chosen a special nation to make them His people and to be the ones through whom the promises would be carried out. And He gave the conditions that they needed to be faithful to Him. They entered into a covenant relationship with Him. They said, "We will do everything that You tell us to do," when they were at the mountain. And of course, that very quickly went very badly, because they quit very quickly doing the will of God. And there were punishments along the way, of course, that they had to deal with. But God had warned them all along that if they didn't straighten up and do what was right, there would be a final reckoning, a judgment that would come upon the nation. Now, as you know, the nation had split into two. The north was called Israel, the south was called Judah. And the nation of Israel basically went into captivity pretty early. And about 722, Samaria was destroyed by the Assyrians. But Judah lasted a little bit longer. They did have some faithful kings, though not many, and they lasted just a little bit longer. But in 586, Jerusalem itself was destroyed. Now we've got to bear in mind that the reason why Jerusalem was so important to them was because this was the place when, during the reign of David, this was made basically the city of God. This was the place where God set His name. This was Zion. This is where the temple was. All the centralization of the nation was placed right there in Jerusalem. So to have Jerusalem be destroyed was just a horrific thing. And they were facing that at that point. Well, this was due to their own sins, of course. They had gone into captivity in Babylon, and Jerusalem was then destroyed, and there they are still in captivity in Babylon, and finally God was going to let them out and come back. And under Cyrus of Persia, they were released and able to come back and begin building the temple once again. Under Zerubbabel, they came back and they began to build the temple around 536-ish. And they quit very quickly for some reason. They were discouraged and they stopped. About 15 years or so, the temple foundation just kind of sat there. And along came Haggai and Zechariah, began to preach to them and tell them, "You need to get back to work." And they finally do. So in about 520, they continue the building of the temple. They finish it in 516. But the problem is, the city is still just sitting there. The temple's now built, but the city is sitting there still kind of in ruins. You know, they haven't built the wall. And back then, if you have a city without a wall, you're very susceptible to raids and attacks. But it just kind of indicated that they still weren't really all that organized. Well, a few years later, Ezra led a return. And then about 444, Nehemiah comes back. But Nehemiah now, if we kind of go back to where he is, he's in Persia the whole time that this is happening. And he is a cupbearer to the king. Now, you know, the king of Persia, you know that being a cupbearer was a very important job. You're the last one, the last defense before something, if somebody's trying to kill the king, poison the king or whatever, you're the one who's got to deal with it. Very important role that Nehemiah plays. And it's clear in the text of Nehemiah that Nehemiah was favored by this king. But Nehemiah gets word that the city is still down, that the wall still not been rebuilt. And I imagine by this time he thought, well, somebody probably should have already undertaken this task. Nobody has. And so when he finds out about this in verse 4 of Nehemiah 1, he sat down, wept, and mourned for days. He's fasting and he's praying. And he confesses the nation's sins before God. "I beseech you, Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who preserves the covenant and loving kindness for those who love Him and keep His commandments. Let your ear now be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant, which I'm praying before you now, day and night, on behalf of the sons of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the sons of Israel, which we have sinned against you. I and my father's house have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you. We have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, or the ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses. And he remembers what this covenant meant in verse 8. He remembers the words that if they were unfaithful, God said, I'll scatter you among the peoples. And that's exactly where they are at this point. But in verse 9, if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though those of you who have been scattered were in the most remote part of the heavens, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place where I have chosen to cause my name to dwell. Now again, there's the issue. I have chosen to cause my name to dwell. Where is it? Now Jerusalem. But Jerusalem is still not really rebuilt. Again, the temple's been rebuilt, but it's just sitting there, and Ezra's trying to get the people back on target with the law. But Nehemiah says, I got to go back. And he beseeches God that he let him return so that he can rebuild the walls of the city. But Nehemiah has a problem. How's he going to get the king to respond to this? So chapter 2 tells us that he's in the presence of the king, and the king notices that he's kind of sad. Why are you sad? What's wrong? You're not sick. This is sadness of heart. And we said in chapter 2 and verse 2, Nehemiah says, I was very much afraid at that point. Here you are standing really in front of one of the most powerful men that's around, and he has the power of life and death over you, and he asks you what's wrong. I love what happens next. He says, let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and gates have been consumed by fire? The king said to me, what would you request? And I want you to notice the last thing said there in verse 4. So I prayed to the God of heaven. One thing you'll notice if you read through Nehemiah carefully is that Nehemiah was a man of prayer. He's constantly praying. And what's impressive to me right here is that he's standing in front of the king of Persia, and his first request goes to God, not to the king. I prayed. Now, I don't imagine that this is some kind of long, drawn-out, 30-minute prayer that we're talking about here. Sometimes people call them target prayers or arrow prayers or something like that, where you just shoot very straight and quick, God, help me with whatever the task is. So whatever it was that he said, he prays to God fairly quickly and then says to the king, if it pleased the king and if your servant has found favor, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. Now the amazing thing here really is that the king says, go ahead. And again, the reason why that's kind of amazing is because of the job that Nehemiah has. This is not the kind of job that you replace easily. You have to be able to trust this person with your life. And he's going to let Nehemiah go. For a time, he wants him to come back. For a time, he could go. And so with the king's blessing, he does just that. And in chapter 2, he gets to the city. Pretty long trip. Probably roughly about a 4-month trip. He gets to the city of Jerusalem. And he goes around the city and just kind of assesses the situation. What's really wrong here? What's going on here? Then in verse 17, he gathers the elders together, the priests, the nobles, and the officials. And he says to them in verse 17, you see the bad situation we're in. Jerusalem is desolate, its gates burned by fire. Come and let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem that we will no longer be a reproach. I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. And they said, let us arise and build. So they put their hands to the good work. You have to be impressed with that. And I imagine you've heard lessons and sermons over the years saying something to this effect, that you'll notice that what is said right here is, let us do this. They don't say, well, then you better hire somebody else to go do that. Or why don't you go ahead and take care of that, Nehemiah? There's a very much a mentality here that we're going to do this together. We're in this together. And of course, there is a vital principle there for a congregation of God's people that we understand that we are a we. We are together here. And let us build. Let us do the work. It's not pointing our fingers at somebody else and saying, hey, that's your job to do. Everybody's in this together. We all need to have that kind of understanding. Now, I wish I could say at this point, the next verse would just say that they built the wall and that was the end of it. But before that wall gets built, there are several issues they have to grapple with. And that's what I want to focus on for just a few moments. The battles that Nehemiah had to fight to get this job done. First, I want to notice here that as they begin the work of building the temple, they have to deal with the battle of ridicule. Look there in chapter 2 and verse 19. We read about Sanballat, the Horonite, Tobiah, the Ammonite official, Geshem, the Arab. Now, we've got to understand the situation here and around Jerusalem. You might be thinking, well, now, what are these guys doing there? Well, you see, all those years that captivity had been going on, a couple of things have happened. Now, the Assyrians, when they took the north captive and destroyed Samaria in about 722, they would take away the people of Israel and leave some of the poor in the land, and then they would repopulate the land with foreigners. So now you basically have what I just kind of like to call the proto-Samaritans, the ones who essentially ultimately become the Samaritans, people in the land who are just gathered there. And they are intermarrying and all of that. So you're going to have some people there that are not Israelites. And by this time, they have claimed these areas for themselves. And so there's going to be a sense, some tension that's there, because they think they have a right to be there, and many of the Jews are going to be thinking, no, they don't have a right to be there. And Nehemiah says, absolutely, this is not your job, this is ours. That's his idea here. But notice what it says. They mocked us and despised us and said, what is this thing you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Now, we already know the answer to that, don't we? The king who's in charge of all this, the Persian, he already gave the blessing for Nehemiah to go do this. But Nehemiah doesn't say, the king is blessing us in this. He says, the God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build, but you have no portion, right, nor memorial in Jerusalem. I'm going to move up to chapter 4 for just a moment, where once again the work is being ridiculed. You know, that's the thing. You can say to somebody, look, we're going to do this work anyway, and they'll likely just keep on ridiculing. You got to understand that when we do the work of God, there will be those who don't like what we do. We already know this from the world. The world doesn't like what we do. The world doesn't like what we stand for. And so you need to expect ridicule. You need to expect the mocking. You need to expect that they will say things and do things that you know are not true, but that's the way they're going to represent what you do and what you are. And they don't want to stop. And what we find is that when Nehemiah and his people there just keep on building, see, the real answer to the ridicule and the mockery is just to keep working. Just to keep building. Trust God, but keep working. Don't quit because people are mocking and ridiculing. But what happens next then is, in chapter 4 and verse 1, when these men like Sam hear that they kept on working, I mean, how dare you ignore our mocking and ridicule, right? How dare you ignore that? It says they became furious and very angry and mocked the Jews. And he spoke in the presence of his brothers and the wealthy men of Samaria, said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can they offer sacrifices? Can they finish in a day? Can they revive the stones from the dusty rubble, even the burned ones?" And Tobiah the Ammonite said, "Even what they're building, if a fox should jump on it, he would break their stone wall down." Biblical trash talk. That's what they're saying. "Hey, look, that wall's so weird. A fox jump up on it and just all fall down. And look how bad this is. You guys," and you know, they're not going to quit. How did Nehemiah handle this? Verse 4, he prayed, "Hear, O our God, how we are despised. Return their reproach on their own heads and give them up for plunder in a land of captivity. Do not forgive their iniquity and let not their sin be blotted out, for they have demoralized the builders." Well, that's kind of like some of the imprecatory psalms. It's based on the covenant. God had promised that he would destroy the enemies. These are clearly enemies, so he's simply praying for that. But then in verse 6, "So we built the wall. And the whole wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work." So regardless of how much they were mocked and ridiculed, they prayed and they kept working. And once again, just to think about the fact that we live in a world that wants to mock and ridicule what we do and who we are as Christians, we need to pray and we need to keep working, not quit. And that'll likely make them even angrier, and they'll ramp it up a little bit and try to make it even that much more embarrassing and all that, but that's what they're going to do. But what happens next is that when the ridicule didn't work, they resort to open warfare. And in verse 7, when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites heard that the repair of the walls of Jerusalem went on and that the breaches began to be closed, they were very angry. And all of them conspired together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause a disturbance within it. When ridicule doesn't do the job, they'll often resort to something even more physical. Now, we realize that ridicule in and of itself doesn't really hurt us. But what happens when people resort to something more physical? They're going to get abusive. They're going to resort to open warfare. Now, the thing about this is that the Jews working on this wall, they still didn't quit. They didn't say, "Well, you know, we were okay with being made fun of, but you know, now you're asking us to fight?" Well, what Nehemiah did was basically whatever was necessary to keep on working. The Jews said in verse 12, "They'll come up against us from every place, wherever we may turn." So he says, "I station men in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, the exposed places. I station the people and families with their swords, spears, and bows. I saw their fear. I rose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses." They kept on working. Verses 15 through 18 says, and so they again were not willing to just quit and stop. And I want you to notice something right here in verse 19. "I said to the nobles and the officials and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we are separated on the wall, far from one another. At whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us." I realize that today We are in a different kind of kingdom. As servants of Christ, we're not picking up swords and guns and things of that nature in order to fight a spiritual battle. That's not the way the kingdom works. But we still have a fight. Ephesians 6 tells us that our fight is not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, the heavenly hosts that are working in this age. That's the fight that we have, is a spiritual battle for the mind. But fight must. And I would remind us that as great as it was for Nehemiah to build a physical wall around Jerusalem, the fight that we're involved in is that much greater because it is a spiritual battle, a battle for the mind, and we need to bear in mind that we're doing this because the work that we're involved in is a great work. This is great. It's extensive. But also, we need to fight for our loved ones, for our families, for our children. We had better be fighting for them. Because if we give it up now, we give up the fight for the Lord now, what kind of world will they be left in to grow up in? What legacy are we leaving for our children? Always be ready. Always be prepared. Verse 22, let each man with his servants spend the night within Jerusalem, that he may be a guard for us by night, laborer by day. Neither I, my brothers, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us removed our clothes. Each took his weapon, even to the water. We're always ready, in other words. We stayed ready. Prepare your minds, Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1. Gird up the loins of your minds. Be ready for action. We have a fight. It's understandable that the world won't like what we do. And it's understandable in another sense that the world will even try to bring some kind of hurt and harm to us. But the third battle that Nehemiah had to fight was not so understandable, because it was a battle on the inside. Look here in chapter 5. You know, the thing about what the devil knows, he knows that if we're not going to budge from people trying to harm us from without, ridicule and all of those things that happen, he can break us down from within. Now there was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brothers. For there were those who said, we, our sons and our daughters are many. Therefore let us get grain that we may eat and live. And there were others who said, we're mortgaging our fields, our vineyards and our houses that we might get grain because of the famine. Now what they're basically doing is saying that we've had to borrow money and our own brothers are charging usury against us. We're helpless because of all this. And I imagine this was one of those situations where Nehemiah just had to shake his head and said, what is wrong with us? We have enough problems from without not to be biting and devouring one another and hurting one another from within. And so it is today. We have enough problems coming from without. We better not be hurting one another from within. As Paul said in Galatians 5:15, you bite and devour one another, beware that you consume one another. Look at his response, Nehemiah's response in verse 6. I was angry when I heard their outcry in these words. I don't read about Nehemiah really being angry before this. That he can handle the outcry from without. He can handle the ridicule, and he can even handle physical attacks. But what made him angry were when his own brothers mistreated each other. And I'll tell you why. Because they knew better. And we know better than to hurt each other. Then in verse 7, he rebuked them. He says, I consulted with myself. I thought about how to handle this. And I contended with the nobles and the rulers and said to them, you are exacting usury each from his brothers, and I held a great assembly against them. He says, we, according to our ability, have redeemed our Jewish brothers who were sold to the nations. Now you would even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us. So he rebukes them. And sadly, sometimes that's what it takes. When we harm and hurt and bite and devour one another, we need to be taken to task for that. Got enough problems from without, and you're causing these problems from within? No. Not acceptable. It says they were silent. They couldn't find a word to say. And I said, the thing which you're doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? The goal was restoration. If you drop down to verse 11, I want you to notice that Nehemiah's goal here was not just to make them feel bad and kick them out. What he's asking them to do is fix it. Please give back to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves, their houses, also the 100th part of the money, the grain, the new wine, and the oil that you're exacting from them. They said, we will give it back and will require nothing from. We'll do exactly as you say. They made a promise. We'll fix it. We'll take care of this. And that's the end of it. The goal is restoration. There's one more thing Nehemiah had to grapple with, and that was the problem of compromise. It's kind of interesting that in chapter 6, now what's happened is that the enemies have tried mocking and ridiculing. They've tried threatening them with open warfare. None of that was working. They kept all through this. They're still working. They're keep it going. And so what they do now is try another tactic. Well, why don't we try to get them to just compromise a little bit? So it's reported to these men, Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, that I had rebuilt the wall and no breach remained, although at that time I had not set up the doors and the gates, so they have it all up except the doors, basically. And so Sanballat sends a message to him. Come, let us meet together at Cherethim in the plain of Ono. But they were planning to harm me, he says. Why don't you just come meet with us? Compromise a little bit. You know, come and we'll meet you halfway and we'll see what can happen. You know, after all this, now they're going to make some kind of indication that they want to be, you know, nice to him. Get him to compromise. But Nehemiah could see through that. I'll tell you, when the world tries to get you to compromise, understand they're trying to get you to compromise. They won't compromise. They might say, hey, well, I'll meet you halfway, but what they're really expecting is for you to come all the way. And once we give in to that, they've won. Nehemiah sent messengers back in verse 3. He says, I'm doing a great work. I can't come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? Why should we quit working just so that we can come down and listen to what you have to say when we already know what your intentions are? Look, I'm all for discussion. I mean, if an unbeliever calls me up and says, I'd like to talk to you about God, I'm happy to do so. But if the effort is simply to convince us, hey, why don't you just come out and be more like the world? Why don't you just come out and join with us a little bit more? And they have no real desire whatsoever to really talk about God and the important things. Look, we got too much to do. We got too much to do to compromise. Nehemiah wouldn't run. He loved the Lord more than his own life. And the result of his persistence, we read in verse 15 of chapter 6, the wall was completed on the 25th of the month Elul in 52 days. You know, it's amazing because maybe 52 days, less than 2 months, they got the walls done. And again, you go back when they first laid the foundation of the temple in about 536, and it sat there for 15 years. Nothing happening. And then when they got back to work, it took them 4 years to finish it. Nehemiah comes along and says, I refuse to compromise. I refuse to give in. I refuse to pay attention to the ridicule. We'll be ready to fight, but we will not quit working. And that kind of persistence paid off. The wall was done. I hope you can see that we face the same kinds of issues today. We face the ridicule. We face the threats of open warfare. We face the problems that come from the inside occasionally. We face the efforts to get us to compromise. But Nehemiah's attitude was, this is a great work. I'm not going to quit. And as we read earlier, the people had a mind to work. All together, let's do this. Let's rise and build. We're in this together. We have a mind to work. We can do this. We can get the job done, regardless of whatever else is going on outside. We have a great work to do with God's people today, with the church today. We have a great mission in evangelism. We have a great mission in edifying one another. We have great work that we are involved in, and let us do it. Have a mind to work. Have a heart for prayer. Have the courage to stand in the face of whatever opposition may come, even if the opposition comes from the inside. Have the courage to stand up for truth and what's right. As we prepare to sing the song that was chosen, I want us to think about our own commitment this evening. The only way someone like Nehemiah could do the work that he did was through a complete, total dedication and commitment on his part. Because someone who isn't committed and dedicated doesn't want to face the ridicule, doesn't want to face the threats, and is in a much more likely position to compromise. But if we know what the enemy's throwing at us, we can deal with it. Because God gives us the strength to do it. The question is, what attitude are we going to bring to the table as we do this great work? If you're not a child of God, think about your relationship with God now. Don't give in to the world anymore. The world isn't going to help you. life to the Lord. Repent of your sins. Be buried with Christ. Have your sins washed away. And if we can help you, if we can pray with you, let us know now. Stand and sing.
Who will follow Jesus searching for